Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. So it's our weekly observance night, the half moon tonight, Friday night, and many people have come to practice with us, meditation, Dhamma reflections. It's also the kind of, we have the double header, Friday night, Saturday night, because tomorrow is also the regular weekly Saturday night talk, so don't know if anybody came tonight maybe expecting to hear Lumpa give a talk, but you have to come tomorrow night for that one. So I've just returned from our hermitage in Washington State, the small town of White Salmon, the Pacific Hermitage. Three of us are three monks in residence in that community, usually at any one time, and with Ajahn Sudanto on retreat in Canada. A few of us have been taking turns filling in. First, Ajahn Yaniko was up there for a few months, and then I spent the last 4.5 months there. You know, Ajahn Jyotipala is there now. And just getting back and settled in here at Abhayagiri, past not quite a week yet. And had a really good time up there in many ways. It's fairly engaged in many ways with the daily alms round and many people with questions and Dhamma questions and issues in their lives that they like to talk about as we go on the alms round on a daily basis. So, and then with teaching engagements, it's all combined a pretty pretty lively kind of scene up there, but also with times for a little bit more simplicity and solitude as well in the lovely forest. So all in all, a very, even though engaged, a very rich, rich experience there for the past 4.5 months. It's also good to come back and see familiar faces and be in this lovely setting, forest, a good community. One of the hallmarks of both places is just the general level of goodwill and harmony in this community. So I feel a lot of gratitude being able to participate in both. The community, the lay community up there, is also very vibrant. In little town of White Salmon, on Tuesday nights when we go to do just this kind of thing, meditation and a bit of Dhamma discussion. Usually no less than 20 or 25 people show up, and oftentimes 35 and sometimes even more than that in this very tiny little town. So there's a real lively interest in the practice. Many of the people are relatively new, but a number of them have had some sort of clandestine meditation experience that they only found out about each other after we started appearing there and having this group. And so it was quite a nice awakening for many of them to find out that they had friends in the same town that were practitioners and have a place to come together to practice now. And one of the common themes that seems to come up in many places, including there, including here, as Buddhist practice has started to take root here in the West is how people are very much attracted, the entry point being the practice of meditation, and how sometimes people struggle with that. And I think we can all relate to that in some ways, that sometimes we go through periods of inspiration, and other times there's periods of frustration in developing meditation practice. And sometimes you just feel like, you know, you're stuck, or even though you've been meditating for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, even 20 years, you have these periods of time where you feel like you've never done any meditation at all. It just feels like what have I been doing all this time? You know, why is the mind so recalcitrant or unwieldy or stubborn? You know, why isn't there more letting go, more peace of mind? So it's a common struggle, common topic of discussion. And I think some of it is owing to the fact that a lot of the way it's come to the West, introduced in the West, is via technique. I was at Yomo in Ukiah a couple of nights ago for our weekly or monthly talk there, and we were talking about right mindfulness as opposed to just mindfulness practice in general. And it was actually this fellow right here in the second row who made a very good comment about, kind of summed it up, that it's like it's a technique rather than it's been pulled out of practice, out of a full practice model, and just been picked up as a technique and developed very strongly that way in the West. And sometimes it's taken out of its context as part of a full path of practice. So I think that sometimes that might, I think that can often be the root of frustration in people's practice in the development of meditation, the practices of concentration, is that we look at it as a specific single technique to help us develop a sense of peace and calm and tranquility, but have taken it out of the context of a fuller practice. And so sometimes we don't understand how we can use other aspects of the path to support a full development that then leads to more ease and progress and satisfaction within the meditation itself. So coming back to the roots, coming back to the origins, coming back to the context, I find is a very important thing to do. And at our conference in England that we had, the overall Ajahn Chah community conference of elders in May in England, it was kind of encouraged for us as monastics to keep on bringing that back to focus. There's going to naturally be ways that these things are adapted as they come into different cultures, and some for very good, you know, good kinds of things have been happening. People developing, you know, better coping skills, dealing with stress, and developing skillful means within the context of society at large. But perhaps the, you know, unique contribution from the monastic community can be to also bring this back into a fuller picture, so that the actual original teachings, with the prominence of the fact that this can be taken further even than it has been, that it is a path that can lead to complete liberation. there's a really, really lovely teaching discourse in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha talks about this specific issue. It's called the Great 40. Probably a number of you are familiar with that. And it's an exposition of the Eightfold Path and how it's a very interdependent kind of a path. It starts out with talking about right concentration, the development of concentration, and basically defining right concentration as a unification of mind that is supported by all of the other factors, the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. So, as we've all talked about on a number of different occasions, the whole Eightfold Path, all of the factors of the path begin with the word samma, or right. So it's like right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And not being so much a term that means right versus wrong, but more right in terms of being in harmony with all the other aspects of the path, right in terms of that they all work together to support each other and feed back on each other as a whole program. And so right concentration is not just concentration. It's a development of a stability, a unification of mind that is fully in tune with many other factors to bring it to its fulfillment. So, you know, you see that with all of it, you can actually really take that into account with all of the factors of the Eightfold Path so that, you know, the Buddha didn't just teach like livelihood. He taught right livelihood. He didn't just teach any kinds of livelihood. Livelihood that's in harmony with the path as a whole. The view is right view. It's not just any, you know, smattering or collection of different views, religious views, spiritual practices of the time. There were many at the time that the Buddha started teaching and practicing. And he goes to a lot of detail, goes into a lot of detail about the views that don't lead one to the goal of liberation, as well as the ones that do. So it's right view, not just views. It's livelihoods that are appropriate, not just right. It's right livelihoods that are appropriate, not just livelihoods or actions and speech, efforts, and mindfulness, not just by themselves, but right in terms of supporting each other on the way towards attaining the goal. In that discourse, he then also moves on to describe the other seven factors and how they kind of interact with each other, and talks about right view being the forerunner at the head of the line of these factors, and right mindfulness and right effort combining with right view as the three aspects of the path that kind of steer the ship in a way, the factors of right view, right mindfulness, right effort kind of swirl around all of the other path factors of livelihood and speech and action to keep focused on the development of those wholesome aspects of those path, to keep on remembering with mindfulness to bring them to mind, to bring them into the practice. So they kind of form the directional, the navigational processes to keep us attuned to the other factors as well. So right view, you know, essentially is at the beginning, where we try and establish, well, what is it that we're actually trying to do with this practice? this development of meditation, this development of mindfulness? What is it that we're trying to do? And so the actual culmination of the practice is a full and penetrative understanding of the Four Noble Truths, the way, the path of leading to the, that leads to the end of suffering. So that's the whole context for it, what we're doing, and we have to start with that framework to keep us in a path that's true. Neatly, the part of the Four Noble Truths is also the Eightfold Path, so that it's all contained within each other. So we have to start out with the what's called more of the mundane right view, which is the idea that our actions have results. That's one of the aspects of mundane right view. That's really important to start right from the very beginning to understand. It's essentially the natural law of karma, that actions have results. And at its most basic and practical way, it means that what we do does make a difference. So that where we put our mind, what we intend to do by body, speech, or mind, will have results, for better or for worse, depending on the intention behind the particular action. But it gives us this sense of, you know, ability to set a direction. We're not just helpless victims in a chaotic world. We can go ahead and realize that there is something that we can do to help improve our circumstances and the lives of ourselves and of other people. And then we can choose a path of action to implement that. So that's the fundamental aspect of mundane right view that's so important. Also, realizing that, there are certain practices like generosity and service and caring that will have an impact on our lives and on our path of practice, parts of mundane right view. Then it goes through the, you know, as one progresses through and develops the other parts of the path, one eventually comes back to the aspect of right view as well, with a deep penetration, a deep understanding of the path of practice, how it will lead to the end of suffering, and when taken to its fullest, a full penetration and understanding of the complete cessation of dukkha, the cessation of suffering. That's the full transcendent realization of right view, the Noble Eightfold Path, the full development of wisdom. So this starts, this is the compass for the practice, the compass for the Eightfold Path that keeps us moving in the right direction. We use that to refer back to all the time to find out if we're practicing in harmony with the path altogether. The other aspects of the Eightfold Path, like right intention, are developed with that in mind, with that goal in mind, right intention, right action, speech, livelihood. Also, right effort being one of the factors that revolves around all of the others is the aspect where it gives us the direction to move towards wholesome, developing wholesome qualities and abandoning the unwholesome qualities. So right effort tells us to develop and really learn right speech, to abandon wrong speech. It tells us to develop and encourage ourselves with right actions, the precepts, how to live a life that's is harmless and respectful of other beings, how to abandon those kinds of actions that result in more suffering for ourselves. and other people, how to choose a livelihood that supports those aspects as well, the aspects of non-harming skillfulness and abandoning those kinds of livelihood, how we live our lives that is hurtful or difficult or painful, causes suffering. So right effort helps move us in that direction of developing the wholesome qualities that are supportive in our lives and in our practice. It's a very important thing to remember, because I think maybe we don't spend quite as much time learning how to just be in the world in a way that that supports our meditation practice. And I think that if we have difficulties in developing concentration, peace of mind, settledness, oftentimes it's because we really haven't put enough attention just in how we live our regular daily lives. And it becomes very difficult to come into a period of meditative practice if we haven't been attentive to these other factors that help to settle the mind, gladden the mind, soften the mind. In obvious ways, the precepts, keeping precepts is the first line of protection against harmful mental states, and that we can always look back on our lives without remorse, without regret, if we've lived a blameless life, or if we've picked up precepts even recently, and we can reflect and see what the difference it makes in our lives and in our mental attitude. So that's a protection that comes out just right in that practice of the precepts to make for a more peaceful mind state. I think all of us too, in the West are many of us live very, very busy, very engaged, very stimulating lives. And you might reflect on that in terms of right livelihood, that even beyond the descriptions of right livelihood as being engaged in activities that are not causing direct harm to other beings. Also, just looking at what it is that we bring into our daily lives, the kind of energy, the kind of entanglement, the kind of busyness. Do we really need to be doing all of this? Do we really need to be engaged at the high-paced, fast, get everything done super efficiently, pack every possible moment with some sort of meaningful activity that seems to be increasing, as far as I can tell, in the world around us. Sometimes when I go and visit family and friends for periods of time, it's just incredible to me, the barrage of stimulation and information that's happening. It seems, maybe it's because I've been in the monastery for more than 18 years at this point, and so I'm really losing track. But it does seem like it's even more intense than when I left. Just the rapidity of information exchange, the number of activities that kids are now engaged with, after school kinds of things and clubs and everything being packed into every possible minute. The internet, of course, is, another place where there's a rapid exchange of information, so much so that I think it's, attention span is much shorter than it used to be. Or just watching TV sometimes in my family's house and seeing the incredible barrage of rapidly changing images and colors and fast, loud talking words happening in a continuous stream. It's this constant, intense entanglement in the world as it is these days. And just if that's the kind of lives we lead, if that's what we're engaged in, and that can happen even in the monasteries, here we have computers and engagement with the outside world and that kind of thing. And we just sometimes, I think, can live a life of intensity that, well, no wonder when we all sit down at the end of the day to have a few quiet moments, that there's the repercussions. All of this keeps playing and refiguring itself over and over again, and it's hard to get the mind to settle. It's only a natural result of that kind of engagement and intensity. So it could be that that if we use our right effort to hone in on our right livelihood, we could say, okay, well, maybe I can let go of some of these things that are resulting in unskillful mental states. Maybe I can simplify my life a little bit. Maybe I can engage a little bit less in the intensity and craziness and chaos of the world around me. How can I move towards a bit more simplicity? How can I develop wholesome, skillful states of mind in relation to a livelihood and engagement? So that's the way that right effort kind of revolves all around the rest of these paths of speech, action, livelihood. And right mindfulness is that third factor that then kind of hovers around and circles around all of the other factors. And once we've got our compass in the right place, we know where we're headed, we know why we're involved with this path, and we're moving towards developing wholesome, skillful states of mind, letting go of the unwholesome ones, then we use mindfulness to remember how to start focusing our energies, focusing our contemplative practice in skillful arenas, so that we're starting to investigate the body, the mind, and different aspects of the teachings and experience. We're learning to keep on coming back to those in ways that are supportive of the entire path. So the activity of right mindfulness, not only just recollecting and learning how to focus in the present moment, but doing it consciously, doing it with a knowledge of that what we are choosing to focus on is part of the path as well, that we can choose to be mindful of aspects of our experience that will lead to calm, peace of mind, and develop insight into how it is that we've gotten to where we are and where it is that we want to go, and how to do that skillfully. So remembering to do that, but in the context of the goal, not just being present for whatever it is that comes our way, but using it as a way to help us focus attention in the right arenas to fulfill the goal. That's right mindfulness. So in the development of right concentration, we're all looking for a little bit of peace of mind in our meditation practice. Really, the work of preparing the mind, of getting it staged in such a way that the ability to focus on an object like the breathing or whatever meditation object that we choose, the ability to focus on those things isn't such a chore. We don't have to try and force ourselves to keep attention on a particular object and have a sense of you know, intense, narrow focus that's almost like a shooting gallery, trying to shoot off all of the things that are detracting us, so that we have a pure, clean mind. It's not a prison state that we're trying to engender with our meditation practice, but rather a natural settling and ease that wants to just be with a simple object to help settle. And that kind of state of mind is a very relaxed, open, happy state of mind that comes from the development of these other factors of the path. It's a quality that's called pamoja, or maybe gladness, softness, ease of mind, that we get through proper reflection. One of the teachings that the Buddha talks about, he says, you know, if you've picked up an object of meditation, like the breath as an example, the breathing, and you find that the mind just doesn't want to settle, that it's engaged in an agitated way, and it's just not wanting to be with that object to allow the mind to focus quietly, then pick up a theme that's inspiring. Stop trying to force the mind onto a single object at that point, but pick up something as a reflection or as a practice that's going to develop a sense of ease, a sense of relaxation, a sense of open contentment and happiness. There's lots of different themes that a person can develop. Several of those themes are devotional kinds of reflections, like reflections on the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, as a way of developing a sense of inspiration, a sense of gladness in the mind. Some of the devotional practices that we do help to support reflections along those lines, like the chanting. Sometimes it's just good to open the mind and settle the mind by doing some chanting that's both energizing and also reflective, and brings up a sense of appreciation for the path, the teacher, the path, and those who are on the path. That's a way to develop a sense of inspiration. Sometimes people will engage in kinds of activities that help support that service in the community, working on projects that are beneficial to the community. Can give a sense of ease, a sense of contribution, a sense of generosity. Other things, other devotional activities, sometimes people get involved with different kinds of spiritual or religious artwork that helps to develop a sense of pamoja, a sense of gladness, ease in their lives. So, generosity, reflections on giving, reflections on virtue, practices that we've picked up, ways of living that we've picked up that are inspiring and leading towards the goal. Reflecting on all of these are ways to help inspire and relax the mind. So it's part and parcel of the practice to bring one's life through practice and reflection and some kinds of devotional kinds of things that help just soften the mind, lead us away from a very tense goal orientation. And these are developed over long periods of time, too. It doesn't all happen at once. But just to step back and relax a little bit and really just get a sense of appreciation for all the things that can be done in the world and in our lives to bring a sense of simplicity and happiness, and to really reflect on those, and just watch and see what happens to the mind when you do that. When you go back and reflect on those kinds of activities, contributions to the world, to your life. And see the sense of relaxed happiness and ease of mind that comes from that. And when you've established that kind of state of mind, then it's appropriate to just gently refocus back on the object, back on the breathing, within that kind of state of relaxed, open gentleness of mind. And then just to be very quiet and focused on a very simple object, and see how within that space of an open mind, the mind just is much more relaxed and able to settle with the object rather than having to force it in any way. The mind just naturally wants to be with it in an easeful way because it's calming, peaceful, and supportive to the development of tranquility, collectiveness. So it's a very natural, it can be a very natural result of living a skillful life, engaging in skillful activities, and then bringing them up and remembering them for reflection. So this development of Pamoja as a precursor to the actual picking up of the meditation object. Once we've established that, we do pick up the meditation object as a way of further refining, further honing in on developing a very stable state of mind. That's what right concentration is all about, is developing a stability and a strength of mind that is very open and peaceful and distilled, but also very energetic and very lively. It's not a dull, withdrawn state of mind. It's a very open, clear, bright, spacious, and very simple state of mind. And that's a very powerful place to be able to reflect on the teachings as well. So you can see that, you know, the development of concentration, the development of meditation practice is really very much dependent on all the other aspects of the path, knowing what it is that we're trying to do with right view, knowing how to put our efforts in the right direction to steer us towards wholesome mental states and away from unwholesome mental states, so that we can then use our mindfulness as right mindfulness to really focus on several aspects of body-mind experience to begin our development of peace, tranquility, concentration, and eventually insight, too, that then leads us back to the full understanding of the path of suffering, how we got there, the path that leads to the end of it, and then the full cessation of dukkha, the full realization of the end of suffering, which is the full path that the Buddha taught and which we are fortunate enough to have the ability and the capacity and the teachings in the world to help us realize those. So I think I'll leave that for this evening, and we'll continue our practice for this evening. Sadu karang dadamase.